Hi, my name is Amy B, and I am a compulsive overeater who is living very gratefully in a recovered state from the food for today, one day at a time. I'm really, really grateful to be here. Thank you so much, Mary Grace, for asking me to speak today. I think the easiest way for me to begin a qualification to tell the story of what it was like before I got here is to start with some photos. I'm not going to spend too long on this, but I think that they say a lot. So here we go. These are photos from various times in my life. I don't have a lot of pictures. This is one of the ways that my disease expressed itself, which is to say, binge eating, compulsive eating, nonstop overeating. I'm over 300 pounds in most, if not all, of these photos. And like I said, I don't have a lot of photos from this expression of the disease because I was either, I hid them or I destroyed them or I hid behind people or I took the photos or whatever it was. So a lot of them are blurry. You can really see this like hallmark roundness, this morbid obesity, which was one of the ways in which my compulsive disordered eating expressed itself, but it wasn't the only way. And the other way it expressed itself looked like this. And I have more photos from this time. This expression of the disease was severe restriction over exercising to the point of injury, and hurting myself just as badly with food and food body behaviors. So, like I said, I have more photos of this time, but it was just as disordered, just as diseased, and just as painful and disconnected. I don't know if you can see, but in the photo where I'm running, it's running a half marathon. The photo where I'm running, I have a something tied around my knee because I was in agonizing pain every single time for a half marathon for 13 miles. Every single time that foot hit the ground, it hurt a lot. But all I knew was pain and punishment. So at least this was pain and punishment where I didn't mind having photos taken. I didn't know anything else. Here's this obligatory bathroom selfie from a point at which I had gotten to a place I had bullied myself with food and exercise into and I'm putting this in air quotes, goal weight. And I managed to, continue bullying myself for a while. And it stayed off for a bit. And I really thought that I had it. I had gone up and down multiple times. I really thought that I had it. But this was before the rooms of OA. And while I had physical recovery, I did not have a spiritual solution, and I did not have any understanding of what it was that was driving me to this self-destructive behavior. So after this comes this. After this comes this. This is the second day, my second day in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous, and the first day of my current abstinence, which is 5 years, 5 months, 5 days. Ooh, look at that, a little magic sprinkle on the day that I didn't even realize. 5, 5, 5, 5 years, 5 months, 5 days. And I say that only as testimony that this program can work one day at a time, because for me, it is always day one. I wake up every single day an untreated compulsive overeater, an untreated disconnected soul. So I say 5 years, 5 months, 5 days as testimony. What it was like, what happened, what it's like now, one day at a time, it adds up. This is a graph of my weight for the 25 years of my life before I came into OA. the 25 years before I came into the rooms of OA, I came in my mid-40s. So my entire adult life. These are swings of over 100 pounds. These are each of them swings of over 100 pounds. And I have this graph titled A Powerless and Unmanageable Life. Because all of it, the ups and the downs, all of it was unmanageable. And you can see at the end, there's this like crawling back, like desperately trying to hold on. And I couldn't do what I had been able to do before because this disease is permanent, progressive, and fatal. And that's what it says in the big book. Permanent, progressive, and fatal. It gets worse. A little piece of my personal history is that my father, and I won't take his inventory, he's not in the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous, so it's not my business. I'm familiar with his life. I grew up with him. He's a type 2 diabetic. He currently has two prosthetic legs. He's had a kidney transplant, heart attack, strokes. He can't see. He's missing several fingers. This was a lifestyle disease. I watched him gain and lose over 100 pounds multiple times during my childhood. He and I used to have discussions about the prison of the food. As a matter of fact, prison is something that he referenced once. I was telling someone this story the other day. What it was like growing up, even before that graph. I knew my dad knew was ashamed like me of food, couldn't control food like me. I recognized it. I knew all of the things. I learned how to eat in secret from him, all of those things. I remember once we were having a conversation about feeling like why and all of we what how could we so much want to like look like a normal person and yet so much want to not stop eating. Like And he said to me one day, I have this sick fantasy that I'll get thrown in jail for like, not anything, evil or anything, but whatever, some whatever. And I'll get thrown in jail and I won't have any choice about what I eat. And maybe then I could finally. I was a child when we had that conversation and I haven't forgotten it. And that was what it was like. And I'm so ashamed, like always so ashamed and always so hiding and trying to figure out how to be a normal person. And that idea that like I needed prison, I'm in prison, I'm imprisoned. That was what it was like. So there's a line in the big book that says we are like men who have lost their legs, they never grow new ones. That's real personal for me. Because my dad has lost his legs. They're never coming back, his whole lifestyle. And I watched that and I will tell you what it was like. I was over 300 pounds when they started cutting toes off of his feet. And I hadn't been to the doctor in years because I didn't want a diagnosis that I wouldn't be able to handle. The day that I found out that my dad was losing his first leg, my toes had just started to tingle. I don't know if anybody knows, but that's like the beginnings of diabetic neuropathy. I don't, it's an outside issue, don't want to get into it, but the point is that I saw all of it and I couldn't tell my mother because I was already in my mid-30s at this point, still before OA, and I went on this extreme restriction and beating myself up. That's where the half marathon picture is in that time in my life because I got so terrified. And this is another thing that it says in the big book. It's not enough. I lost all the weight. I got the polka dot dress. I was in a national magazine as a transformation story. But it's not enough. The praise isn't enough. The fear isn't enough because I didn't have a spiritual solution and I didn't understand. So after that polka dot dress comes 300 pounds again. And not just 300 pounds again, but like my life on paper looked good, like loving partner, healthy children, roof over my head, stable employment, like friends and people who love me. And I couldn't find happiness. I was just in such despair. I ended up in a therapist's office because my life was falling apart. And I sat on her couch and I wept about just how brokenhearted I was and how I just didn't know how to connect. And I just felt a feeling I've come to identify now after a lot of work in the rooms as homesick, like in a greater sense, and like feeling like I'm separated by like a glass that I don't know what it is, and I can't get through it. And home is on the other side, and I'm just disconnected, and everything is pain, and the food is just numbing, whatever. So I'm in the therapist's office and I'm talking about this. And at the end of the hour, like the end of the appointment, like as an aside, I say to her, "Oh, by the way, I've gained and lost over 100 pounds multiple times, and I can't believe I have to do it again. Can't believe I have to do it again." She said to me, "Oh, you need OA." And I went up. And I was so exhausted and done and empty and like out of any kind of, well, I thought I was out of resistance. I was not. Anyway, in that moment, what I said to her was, "Look, I'm desperate and I'll try anything, but I'll tell you right now, I'm going to have a problem with the God thing." And she said to me, "Okay, well, go to a meeting, see how it is, whatever." Now, I spent a little too much time talking about what it was like. It's a connection to like why I need OA, why I need the big book, and why I need a power greater than myself. So I came into the rooms and the first meeting that I went to on May 1st. And by the way, I love that my first meeting was May 1st. Here's why. May 1st is a holiday that's called May Day. And a May Day is a cry for help. I recognize that later. And I will tell you, my problem with the God thing has turned into such a personal love for a higher power that loves me in a way that, like, I was given the gift of May Day, a cry for help, and the recognition that that forces beyond my power were summoning that so I could understand. Also on the first meeting that I went to, I'm looking at the time. The first meeting that I went to, it was 6 minutes from my house. It was in a building of a religion that I did not grow up in, but I will be honest with you, had it been the religion that I'd grown up in, I don't think I would have been any more comfortable anymore at home. Regardless of that, the woman who was at the front was telling a story that didn't really resonate. Me. Her disease didn't express like mine did. Her upbringing wasn't like mine was. Her conception of a higher power, I didn't have a conception, but it wasn't anything that I could have connected to. And I was so sad. And I was in the back of the room and I just was holding back the tears. And I could get that, like, I needed something, but I didn't hear it. And again, I was like, another way where I just don't belong, where I'm behind the glass and can't get through. And I wanted to get out of that meeting, and somebody said to me, "Oh, we have newcomer packets. Hold on, we'll find one." And I'm like inching towards the door. And this woman kindly reached out gently, grabbed my wrist gently, gently, and said, "Hey, can I take a number and you can have mine? And then if you have any questions." And I would have cut off my arm to get out of that room. So I gave her my number and I took hers and I left. And I was crying before I got to my car. And I went home and I drove home and I had what has turned out to be my last non-abstinent meal. And I had no idea that that was going to be the case. And I will tell you right now, it was the worst farewell tour ever. It was like my kids' frozen stuff from the freezer. Because even that way, I was exhausted. And I just, whatever. And I went to sleep crying. And when I woke up the next morning, the first thought on awakening was, that woman was so nice to me last night. And I picked up my phone and I texted her. I said, thank you for being so nice to me last night. That's like how starved I was for like any kind of hope. And she sent back a text which saved my life. A lot of things saved my life, but one of the things that saved my life, which was a text that said, you know, not every meeting is for every person. Come back, listen to different stories. Wait, what a concept which I have come to identify is we are a vast and varied fellowship. Our upbringings, our conceptions of a higher power, how our disease expresses itself. So there's a whole bunch of us. Come, listen, look for the similarities and learn from the differences. That's been a beautiful journey. Anyway, I went to a different meeting that very next night after saying I would never go back. I went to a meeting that very next night, 40 minutes from my house. There was a woman at the front who was telling my story. And I burst out in tears and I said, I need help. I need help. That was May 2nd. And on May 4th, I didn't have a big book yet. The woman who was my very first sponsor, which was a brief but beautiful relationship, had sent me a photo of the For Today reader for that day. And I had diagrammed it like an English assignment because I was going to get Gold Star in recovery. And I went for a walk to think about it. And I had a spiritual experience through the words of a song where I heard the song was not a duet, it's not two voices, wasn't a conversation. And yet, in those lyrics, I heard a back and forth between my broken heart and a loving higher power in which I was saying, I can't do this anymore. And the love was saying, I know, you don't have to, I'm here. And I busted out crying, like I went back to my, and I picked up my notebook, that same thing, and I started writing all of these things about just the force of love, the force of the universe. And then I went to date the page, and it was May 4th. Are any other Gen X kids or whatever? May the 4th be with you. May the force be with you. And I had just written about the force of love and the force of universe. And I wrote May the 4th, and then I wrote next to it, okay. Okay. That was the beginning of a whole bunch of defiance and denial and resistance and broken ideas and new ones that grow and setting aside fixed ideas. I have 2.5 minutes left. I want to read a passage from page 27 in the big book. And there is a solution. This is where one of the original before went was seeking help, and they said to their doctor, you know, they were talking with their doctor about their hopelessness. Doctor said, you have the mind of a, I'm gonna, please forgive me, I'm gonna insert addict for alcoholic just to make it connected. I appreciate the grace. You have the mind of a chronic addict. I have never seen one single case recover where that state of mind existed to the extent that it does in you. Our friend felt as though the gates of hell had closed on him with a clang. He said to the doctor, is there no exception? Yes, replied the doctor, there is. Exceptions to cases such as yours have been occurring since early times. Here and there, once in a while, addicts have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these people, are suddenly cast to one side, cast aside, set aside, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of my life. I'm in prison. It would take prison. I'm alone. Nothing will work. Ideas, attitudes, and emotions that were the guiding force of my life, pulling me away, defecting. Defect is a verb too, which means to abandon one's home country or cause for an opposing one. Defecting, running away from home. Those ideas and attitudes that were the guiding force of my life, pulling me to defect from my home cause, the force of love, could be cast to one side, could be set aside for a new idea to begin to dominate them. Just begin. A willing, open mind was what got me into the rooms, and I have to practice the set-aside prayer one day at a time. I didn't get to talk much. I know the time is up. I didn't get to talk much about what it's like now. But I will say that abstinence and pursuit of higher power and emotional sobriety is not prison. It's relief. It's truly relief. And I hope I said something that was helpful. Thank you, and I pass.